the book of Luke, verses 14 through 23. And when the hour came, he sat at table and the apostles with him. And he said to them, I have earnestly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I tell you, I shall not eat it until it is fulfilled in the kingdom of God. And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he said, Take this and divide it among yourselves. For I tell you that from now on, I shall not drink of the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, This is my body, which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And likewise the cup after supper, saying, This cup, which is poured out for you, is the new covenant in my blood. But behold, the hand of him who betrays me is with me on the table. For the Son of Man goes as it has been determined, but woe to that man by whom he is betrayed. And they began to question one another which of them it was that would do this.
This chapter opened. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew near, which is called the Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people. It would be, by the least estimates I've seen, at least 100,000 people in Jerusalem for this Passover feast. With so many people everywhere, it would be easy enough for any person who wanted to hide himself. On the other hand, these Jewish leaders knew that if they tried to arrest Jesus in public, they might set off a riot, or worse. So they wanted some quiet way to make the arrest, take him away, do the trial, and not let the multitudes know it until it was too late to reverse it. Then Satan entered into Judas called Iscariot. First time Satan's been mentioned since chapter 4, verse 13, when the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness ended. Judas was one of the number of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers how he might betray him to them, and they were glad and engaged to give him money. So he agreed, sought an opportunity to betray him to them in the absence of the multitude. Then came the day of unleavened bread on which the Passover lamb had to be sacrificed. So Jesus sent Peter and John saying, Go and prepare the Passover for us that we may eat it. They said to him, Where will you have us prepare it? He said to them, Behold, when you've entered the city, a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him into the house which he enters. I mentioned a couple or 3 weeks ago that a man carrying a jar of water would be as unusual as a man today carrying a woman's umbrella. He would be easily identifiable because this was a woman's work in that day. Follow him to the house he enters and tell the householder, The teacher says to you, Where's the guest room where I'm to eat the Passover with my disciples? And he will show you a large upper room furnished. There make ready. And they went and found it as he had told them, and they prepared the Passover. Meeting in an upper room reminds many students of the text of what's said in Acts 1 after the resurrection of Jesus. Then they returned to Jerusalem from the mount called Olivet, which is near Jerusalem, a Sabbath day's journey away. And when they'd entered, they went up to the upper room where they were staying, and then the disciples are named. Was it the same upper room in which they'd celebrated the Passover? In Acts 12, when Peter had been released from prison, he could scarcely believe they'd been led out by an angel in the middle of the night. When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying, which raises the question, is that the same house? There are those who believe that the upper room had originally been John Mark's home, that John Mark is probably the man carrying the pitcher of water. We can't know that. Actually, Jesus has so many unnamed friends through the Gospels that he could have asked any of those for a room in which to observe the Passover. Rembrandt is one painter who has tried to bring out the unnamed people, the tax collectors, the women, the children, the shepherds, the wise men, the prostitutes, the various people that Jesus had time for, no one else seemed to have time for. A boy with a lunch, 5 loaves and 2 fish. He has them as the shadowed people in the back of his painting. Whoever this was, Jesus had evidently made preparation with him, an agreement with him ahead of time that he could use the room, and that's where they would get together to celebrate the feast. And so the disciples went in to be guests of Jesus at the supper. There was a beautiful tradition about guest rooms. You may remember that in 2 Kings 4th chapter, Elijah passed a certain area so often that a wealthy woman of Shunem said to her husband, "The man of God is always coming this way. Let's build a guest chamber for him." And so they built a guest chamber up on the roof, large room on the bottom floor, and then a smaller room sitting like a box on top of it with an outside entrance. This one was furnished, probably meaning it had carpet, certainly meaning it had couches on which people could rely, because that's what they did at the supper. But the woman of Shunem and her husband built that guest room, and whenever Elisha would come that way, he would turn in. It had a lamp, a table, a chair, a bed. Eventually, that tradition passed over to the thought of a guest room in one's heart, a place in your heart for the Messiah to dwell. Jesus takes the disciples in to be his guests for the supper. The word guest is a magic word. You act differently when there's a guest in your home. Your speech, your manners, everything will indicate that someone special is here. You bring out the best dishes. You are at your best to try to make this person feel very welcome, feel special in your home. And so Jesus seats these 12 men around a table. They're going to observe the Passover, 12 ordinary men. They had not had the word saint attached to their names at this point. They were men. I expect that all 12 of them are here this morning because they were typical men. They were representative men. At least 11 of them are here. And I'd like, as we think about who's around that table, for you to think about which one you are. There was Simon Peter. He was a very impetuous person, burly fisherman. I suspect he had some rough language. I know he knew some curse words. But Simon Peter was one to express himself before he thought. Even after the resurrection, he told the other disciples, "I'm going fishing." And when they'd fished all night and caught nothing, Jesus appeared on the shore. He was 100 yards away. They didn't recognize him. And he said, "Children, have you caught any fish?" And they said, "None." And he said, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat." They did and caught more than they could haul into the bank. And John said, "It's the Lord." And Peter immediately wrapped his clothing around him, jumped in the water and swam to shore. He couldn't wait for the boat. Over at Caesarea Philippi, when Jesus said, "Who are men saying I am?" Jesus said, "You're the Christ." Well, he first gave the report, "But who do you say?" And Peter's the one who answers. In that upper room, when Peter said, "Lord, you're not going to wash my feet." Jesus said, "If I don't wash your feet, you don't have any part with me." Peter said, "Lord, not just my feet, my hands. Wash everything. If that makes me a part of you." He's the impetuous, the quick-spoken one. Or there's James. James never appears in the gospel apart from his brother John. He never appears but once, and that's in Acts 12 at his martyrdom. When James is put to death by Herod, he's separated from his brother John. Must have been modest, somewhat quiet. And then there was John. For some reason, Jesus called those boys sons of thunder. One day they passed through a village in Samaria, and one of them proposed, "Lord, do you want us to call down fire from heaven and consume them?" When the people didn't readily receive Jesus, let's burn the town down. And Jesus said, "You don't know what manner of spirit you're of." That same John, when he was an old man, according to the best tradition we have, lived in the Ephesus area. And when he got to the point he couldn't even walk alone, they'd carry him to church. And he was weak, couldn't say much, but they'd hold him up and he'd say, "Little children, love one another." He was at some stage of that maturity, sitting around the table that night at the Passover. There was Andrew. Andrew, according to John 1, was the first disciple to attach himself to Jesus. He appears three times in the Gospels. Every time he's introducing somebody to Jesus. First time he brought Simon Peter to him, his brother. Next time he brought a lad who had those 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. Here's a lad, he has some food, it isn't enough. But it was a start. The third time was when the Greeks came, and they came to Philip. And Philip went to Andrew, and they went together to Jesus and introduced the Greeks to Jesus. And then there's Philip. He must have been accessible, approachable. He was the one who apparently first knew the boy was there with the the lunch. At least he said, Lord, if we had a year's pay, we couldn't feed all these people. 200 denarii wouldn't be enough bread for all of them to have even a little. And when the Greeks came, the strangers, the foreigners, and went to see Jesus, they came to Philip, the approachable one, open to other people. And then there was Thomas, a fellow who couldn't live with an unasked question. The fellow who was a little cynical. One day the Lord said, I'm going back to Judea. My friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. They said, are you going over there where they tried to stone you not long ago? And he let them know he was walking in the daylight. Thomas said, well, let's go die with him. And then later, after the resurrection, Thomas said, I'm not going to believe it. Not unless I can put my finger in the nail prints and thrust my hand into his side. I won't believe it, see? And then when Jesus presented himself to the test and said, Thomas, go ahead, stretch forth your hand. Thomas gave the greatest confession ever given in the Bible of Jesus. My Lord and my God. And then there was Matthew, tax collector. He worked for the foreign power. Levi, son of Alphaeus, he's called. Maybe the brother of James, son of Alphaeus, who's another apostle. At any rate, the Jews would have had nothing to do with him. They wouldn't have allowed him close in their worship. That's why in Jesus' parable, the Pharisee and the publican stood afar off, beating himself on the breast and said, Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner. Tax collectors were debarred from the Jewish worship because they were traitors. They're listed even in the New Testament with the pagans, the Gentiles, with the prostitutes. They're the class of people who are not favored by anyone. And then there was Bartholomew. Bartholomew appears in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, is never mentioned in John. Nathanael is mentioned in John, is never mentioned in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, leading to the good supposition that Nathanael and Bartholomew are the same person, because Bartholomew simply means son of Talmai. If that is the case, Nathanael is first seen by Jesus under a fig tree. In those one-room homes in Palestine, they would plant a fig tree near the door. And when it was fully grown, it would be 15 feet high, maybe 25 feet wide. And the person would go out and sit, read, or pray, or meditate under the fig tree. Nathanael's probably a meditative type, Bartholomew. And then there was James. All we know of James, son of Alphaeus, is his name, unless he was a brother of Matthew. And then there was Simon the Cananean, or sometimes he's called Simon the Zealot. The Zealots were the people who brought the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. They carried the sikkah, the little curved sword, around under the robes, ready anytime someone started a riot against the Roman oppressor to pull it out and fight to the death. And enough of them pulled them out and fought that the Roman army flattened the city of Jerusalem and killed many of the people in it. Simon was a zealot sitting alongside Matthew, who worked for the Roman government. And then there was Thaddeus. He's also called Judas, not Iscariot. The only time he ever appears in the Gospels alone is in John 14, when Jesus is giving that night before his death speech to the disciples. And he says, I'll manifest myself to you, but not to the world. And Thaddeus just couldn't sit there any longer. He said, Lord, how are you going to show yourself to us and not to the world? And then there was Judas Iscariot. There were two Kerioths. One was over in Moab across the Dead Sea. The other was in Judea, leading us to suspect that Judas was from Kerioth in Judea, the only non-Galilean in the 12, the one who for some reason betrayed his Lord for 30 pieces of silver. And there they sit, guests around the table, about ready to observe the Passover. And one of them is probably very much like you as you're ready to observe the feast today.
Christ, we do
Joab had pierced the 3 darts through Absalom's heart. King's son was dead. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, for Joab restrained them. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest, and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own house. Now Absalom in his lifetime had taken and set up for himself a pillar, which is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and is called Absalom's Monument to this day. If you should visit the city of Jerusalem today, you'll be shown in the Kidron Valley alongside the Mount of Olives, Absalom's Monument. I suppose nothing is more certain than that it is not the one Absalom himself built. It doesn't show the evidence of that kind of age. It is a reminder that someone wanted to keep the memory of Absalom alive. A reminder that we dot the world with our wooden and stone and bronze memorials because no one of us can quite stand the thought of being totally forgotten. We want to be remembered. Jesus would often take simple things and make object lessons from them for his disciples. He would take a pearl and say, that's so valuable. The kingdom of God is like a pearl of very great price. Sell everything else you have and buy it. He would take a lily and say, isn't that beautiful? God made that. He clothed it, gave it its colors. That's the way his providence will care for you as well. He'd take a lamp and say, you're a city set on a hill. Your light shouldn't be put under a bushel. You're supposed to give light to everybody else. But on this night, he didn't choose any of those things. Not a lamp, not a pearl, not a lily. He took something so common that the poorest people in the world, unless they are in starvation, will have it. A piece of bread. And this common bread, he said, is my body. I doubt if his disciples half understood what he was talking about. But after he was gone, when they would eat the bread, they'd remember his body and they'd feel especially close to him. There is not any spot on earth today where you can go and visit the remains of your Lord. You can go to the tombs of the founders of this country and the founders of other countries, but his tomb is empty. But there is a place because he wanted to be remembered. And that's why we come here and meet around this table every first day of the week. Here. And that would be followed by drinking the first of 4 cups of wine on the table. And there would be a dish of herbs and sauce as well. Then the story of the institution of the Passover, when the Israelites were delivered at the conclusion of the 10th plague in Egypt from their slavery, would be recited. The 113th Psalm would be sung because it celebrates God's deliverance of Israel. And they would drink the second cup. Then after another prayer of grace or thanks, the main meal would be observed, consisting of a roast lamb, unleavened bread, some bitter herbs. And after these had been eaten and there'd been another prayer, the third cup of wine would be drunk. And then they would sing Psalm 114 through 118, other psalms of thanksgiving to God for his deliverance. And finally, the fourth cup was drunk. In the midst of that feast, there were 3 rings of bread on the table. The 3 rings of bread would be broken by the host before they were given to the people, because when they were slaves in Egypt, they never had a whole loaf. They only had crumbs. And taking that crumb, that small bit of bread, would remind them that this is the bread of affliction. It's the bread which your ancestors ate in Egypt. And the host would say, this is the bread of affliction which our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. Whoever's hungry, let him come and eat. Whoever's in need, let him come and keep the Passover with us. Jesus looked at that bread of affliction, and then he took part of it, and he blessed it, and broke it, and said, this is my body. It's given for you. And so we eat the bread. Besides the bread was a piece of parsley or lettuce and it was dipped in salt water and eaten. The parsley was supposed to be a reminder of the hyssop they'd used to apply the blood to the lintel and the doorpost to avoid the 10th plague in Egypt. And the salt water was supposed to remind them of the tears they shed in Egypt as slaves, and perhaps of the waters of the Red Sea which they crossed. There were bitter herbs to be eaten to remind them of the bitterness of their affliction when they were slaves. There was paste to remind them of the clay out of which they had made bricks. There were cinnamon sticks to remind them of the straw which had been used to make those bricks as well. And then there was the roast lamb, the Passover lamb which had been sacrificed for them. Along with this were four cups of wine that I mentioned a while ago. Apparently the background for those four cups is in Exodus 6, verses 6 and 7, where God made four promises to Israel as he prepared to lead them out of bondage. And each of those promises was commemorated by a cup. Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will deliver you from their bondage. And I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. And I will take you for my people, and I'll be your God, and you shall know that I'm the Lord your God who has brought you out from under the burden of the Egyptians. I'll bring you out, I'll deliver you, I'll redeem you, I'll take you as my own. Jesus took one of those cups, and he said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. You do this as often as you drink it, in remembrance of me. And so we drink the cup. If some Christians from the first century should come into our assembly this morning, they probably would be confused, mystified by what they see here. To see us sitting in nice clothing, in beautifully comfortable surroundings, an attractive building, meeting and open with the day free for this kind of activity. Even the four-part harmony would seem strange to them. But when they saw us break the bread, and when they saw us raise the cup, they would know whose we are and whom we serve. That's what they did when they met to worship. We all have some special things around our homes that remind us of earlier days. I have a junk drawer. It wouldn't mean anything to anybody else, but it's important to me. My dad had an old showcase on his counter, and there was a money drawer in the middle of it, and he displayed some things that were for sale in his country store in the other compartments, and it's a coffee table in our den. And just outside our bedroom at the end of the hall is a picture hanging. It's old. There are obviously some pieces missing from it if you look carefully, but it was given to my mom when she was 9. It's the earliest thing I remember in my bedroom as a child. You probably have something that really takes you back to people that are important to you, memories that shaped your life. What Jesus wanted was something like this that would form a memory and that would shape our lives. It would give you something special to come and look forward to together. Somewhere there was a story that floated among several church bulletins a few years ago. Seems that a new minister had moved to town, and he called on this home a certain afternoon. And he asked the wife a strange question. She didn't really know how to answer. When her husband came home that afternoon, she said that the new preacher came by today for a visit. And her husband said, well, what did he have to say? She said, he asked me an unusual question, and I didn't know how to answer. And the husband said, what was the question? She said, he asked me, does Christ live here? And the husband said, well, why didn't you tell him? We're members of the church. She said, he didn't ask that. And he said, well, why didn't you tell him we live clean lives and we go to worship every Sunday and we read the Bible and we give? And she said, he didn't ask any of that. He asked, does Christ live here? And that bothered me. How is it in your guest chamber? The guest chamber of your heart, does he live in you? Could we help you with that relationship? Is there something you need to do? Do you need to obey his will? Would you come and let us know the way we can help while we stand and sing? You be seated, please. Jamie Lawrence is placing membership with us at Highland Street. She lives on